What's up? Welcome to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd, my co-host, still in California, laid up in California, resting and recovering, is Canucks insider who also covers the team for The Athletic, Thomas Drantz. Canucks Talk is brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at dleamc.com. We are live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet, what are you waiting for? 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. How's it going, Drantz?
Well, I'm still milking this injury.
A regular Elias Pettersson over here.
Oh, how dare
somebody
you.
Somebody had to say it.
Yeah, I'll be back for next week, and we'll see how it goes. But yeah, down here, recuperating for a little bit longer before I make a 21-hour drive on a, you know, still very touch and go right ankle.
Well, wishing you all the best in that recovery process, and we look forward to getting you back in studio here. It feels like we're on the cusp, obviously, of actual NHL offseason starting, right? Game 5 tomorrow down in Florida. Florida with another chance to wrap it up after getting thumped on Saturday in Edmonton.
How do you feel about that?
About them getting blown out?
Well, is the stage just set for like the world's most gentlemanly sweep?
That's
that your gut?
Mostly how I feel. Yes. Like I to me it's not that much different than if they had lost like 3-1. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think you could make the argument it's actually less damaging than if they had, you know, choked away a lead in the last minute and lost on a heartbreaker or something like that, right? Like, the game was just over so soon. It's not great, don't get me wrong, but I'm not like, oh, the Panthers are reeling, they're on the ropes just yet.
I mean, I agree with that, and you know, I had the Panthers in five, so this, like, script is shaping up the way that I wanted it to. And yet now on the precipice of having good feel for the Stanley Cup final, you know, I do think it matters that they chased Bobrovsky.
Mm.
You know, like, let's be real, right? Like, that's been maybe the story in Florida building a 3-0 lead. The fact that they planted a seed of doubt there,
mm-hmm.
I think is interesting. That gives me pause that, you know, game five might actually be a sweat for the Cats here. I think it will be. I honestly think this series, in a lot of ways, I thought Florida would have a bigger edge than I think they've actually had in this series outside of Bobrovsky's play. And I think they're in tough in game five. I think this is going to be a really interesting game.
Well, and look, I'm not, I don't want to get ahead of ourselves here, but the math and everything in the situation starts to get really interesting if they lose tonight, right? Like, this is the opportunity right here, the one to take if you're the Florida Panthers, because all of a sudden you lose. Not sorry, I shouldn't say tonight. It's tomorrow night that game five goes. But you lose in game five, and then you're going back to Edmonton, and then you're one game away from a coin flip in game seven, right? So it starts to it goes from, oh, we're so comfortable, no team's ever done this, to, uh-oh, we're reeling a little bit in a hurry, and the swing on that is the game tomorrow. So I expect that they're going to be, you know, you have the extra day off for the travel. I think Paul Maurice has done such a good job with that team. This is their second year in the Stanley Cup final. I expect them to really come out and take care of business tomorrow night. But Edmonton's a good team, right? So it's not as easy as just, hey, we're going to come out and play well and win. There's always more to it than that.
Yeah, I mean, look, we'll see. The series, I'm always skeptical when a team's got like an 11-2 goal differential and that has no reflection or no bearing, no relationship with what we're actually seeing in terms of what both teams are generating.
Mm-hmm.
I always expect it to narrow. I don't always expect it to narrow in one game.
Yeah.
But but it did. And, you know, I do think, like, can you win the Conn Smythe
if you've given up 8 goals in a game?
Well, if you're your own team's, like, fifth most important player.
Yeah. I mean, that we're going to have Kyle Bukauskas from Sportsnet on at 1, and that's one of the questions I'm going to ask him. Like, is that it for Bobrovsky's Conn Smythe case? Right? Like, it's pretty tough to be like, oh, we only won because of me, when you get ventilated like that in a game in the final.
I'll be honest, I thought his Conn Smythe case was always a conned Smythe case. It was always an absolute joke. What do you think about the McDavid Doncic, both in the same year, both with series that are unfolding along wildly parallel paths, like down to the late comeback in game 3, by the losing team. And both of them have buzz that they could win the MVP in a losing effort. What are your thoughts? Should you be able to win playoff MVP if your team doesn't win?
Oh, 100% you should. Absolutely you should.
I mean,
we've seen it. Now,
I'm okay with it.
It's much harder in the NBA because it's just finals, right? So it's like, well, you didn't even win this series, so that makes it a lot trickier. In the NHL, yeah, no doubt you should be able to. It's a high bar, for sure, right? And we'll see what Connor McDavid does however long this series goes to make that a conversation, but I have no problem with that whatsoever. I do find it fascinating, the similarities, and I wonder how much of it is just it's so hard to match the desperation of a really good team when they're down 3-0 playing possibly their final home game of the season.
Totally.
And you know, even if you lose, you're just going back home with a chance to win the title in front of your home fans, right? I'm not saying either the Celtics or the Panthers like consciously mailed game four in, but I think that's pretty crucial context here, and fascinating that we've seen, as you said, almost the exact same script in both series.
Well, wives and families fly in.
Yeah,
you know, like it's distracting. I'll tell you, to this day, one thing Canucks management regrets from 2011 was bringing friends and family to Game Six. Like it spiraled a little bit, or just like, you know, really they should have just gone on a business trip to Boston with no special fanfare, no special guests, nothing. I do think there's a mental side to it in both scores. And here's another one that's weird for you. Like, this is just a weird theory. The fact that we're having the discussion in both of the leagues that are having finals right now, do you think it's in any way connected to the fact that Jerry West also passed away this week? West, of course, famously won the MVP, right? In a losing effort, like multiple times. One of the unluckiest players, frankly, in the history of pro sports. Did that like put it into the zeitgeist, or do you think this is just two really unique
cases?
No,
because I think
preposterous theory.
I might have put it in the zeitgeist for the NBA because it's so rare. Like, has it happened since Jerry West in the NBA? But I feel like we have a version of this debate almost every year in the NHL, right? Where there's like, because there's always a standout performer on the losing team, and now it depends on how the actual final goes, but I think you're all there. There's always some version of that conversation in the Stanley Cup final. But maybe Jerry West did it for the NBA. By the way, Jerry West's record in finals was like 1-7 or something like that. Like, he won the one NBA finals. And I'm so glad that he played when he did and not today, where that would be the story of his career. You know what I mean? But now, instead, he played back then. He gets to just be like a revered legend for everything he did.
Yeah, I mean, I do get increasingly nauseated by the idea, like, you make it to the Stanley Cup final, that's an accomplishment, but then we treat it as this standalone where there's, like, a big loser, and it's like, these teams are both incredible. Like, it's a thing that always kind of bothers me, and we talk about a fair bit, the idea that only one team gets to celebrate, that leagues should find ways for more teams to be considered to have had a successful season than they currently do. So, anyway, I'm with you. I hate that stuff thoroughly. Also, just before we move on, Forsling or Barkov should be the MVP if Florida wins, in my opinion. I don't think they should give it to McDavid if he doesn't win. I do think it should be one of Forsling or Barkov. And I think it's really important to note this because increasingly I'm seeing like the defense versus offense story of this Stanley Cup final. But like, make no mistake, what's made Florida special throughout this run is actually pretty similar to what's made Edmonton's special throughout this run, which is that Bouchard, McDavid on the ice, no one can hit Edmonton's fastball. Forsling and Barkov on the ice, no one can hit Florida's fastball, and now they've sort of thrown them at each other, and it turns out that Edmonton's kind of having more success finding contact against that fastball despite the results. So, you know, these teams are both winning at the top end, and I think one way or another, one of those four gentlemen, should be the Conn Smythe. In both cases, it's winning the matchup at the top of the lineup that has put these teams over the top, in their respective conferences and got them to within, you know, one win of the Stanley Cup final in Florida's case and three wins from pulling off, you know, a historic comeback in Edmonton's case.
My pick would be Barkov. I said it on Friday and still, especially if they get it done in game five tomorrow night. I'm going with Sasha Barkov for the Conn Smythe. Okay. Let's get into a little bit of Canucks talk here. It's the show is called Canucks Talk, so let's do it. We are 2 weeks away from the start of unrestricted free agency, which means it's time for target lists up from you and Harmon Dial at The Athletic, Drancer. And I know there's going to be a
We've got four lists, baby.
Yes, let's go.
Four lists. This is list week.
It is target list week. And really, I mean, it is right around the corner that we're going to see this team sign players, right? Sign players from outside the organization. We're probably going to see a bunch of high-profile players, or at least a couple of high-profile players, depart the organization. And the list you had up today at The Athletic focused specifically not on positional need necessarily, or kind of who they should be after more than other players, but specifically on the speed factor, right? Which is, as you mentioned, something that Patrick Alvin highlighted as his end-of-season media availability, wanting to bring more speed to the team. And, you know, I do think it's, before we get into some of the individual players on the list and what they might cost, how they might be a fit, the speed thing is interesting because, you know, I heard Halford and Brough talking on the morning show today, reacting to what Rick Tocchet had to say on Darren Millard's podcast, The Chirp, about trying to bring more off the rush, trying to do more off the rush offensively. And I think it's easy to think of speed as a kind of finesse element to the game, right? Hey, we're going to get faster and then we're going to generate more rush chances. But to me, that's a secondary concern. It might be a nice thing to have if you have more speed in the lineup. The biggest thing for me is about the forecheck. And that doesn't come down to just speed, right? There's skill there. You need physicality. You need all of that. But when I think about, okay, how can they bolster this team while still retaining a key part of the identity? It's if you add an element of that speed into your lineup, especially up front, the forecheck was such a big part of this team and how they had success. I think anything you can do to kind of supplement that and make that a strength going forward is really important. That's the first thing to me that you're trying to achieve if you're trying to inject speed into this lineup.
Yeah, so I've got a complicated set of reactions to what you just said. I think you're fundamentally correct, though, right? Like, we talked about it a little bit with, like, for example, the Lafferty DiGiuseppe fourth line and how it had, you know, value above and beyond their production, because at the very least, when, you know, JT Miller took a breather, or Elias Pettersson took a breather, or Elias Lindholm took a breather, the Canucks would throw out, you know, a fourth line that could still play the same style, mm-hmm. the same sort of lockdown style that we saw this Canucks team rely on all year. And so that the forecheck is, I think, is a good place to start, because the Canucks are arsonists in terms of how they create offense, right? They're there to break down what you build. They're not necessarily there to build their own sandcastle. And you know, they had a lot of success with sort of quick strike offense against the grain, or with, you know, their collection of second stick perimeter shooting after withering persistence in the offensive zone. But for me, the thing is it's what made this Canucks team special was how consistently they were able to play this style with speed along the wall, right? Good centerman, and then size on the back end. And that's why you remember we had the debate about the Pettersson back check, right? And how he's forcing the forward into the weak side, like along the wall, so that to establish effectively that Canucks neutral zone wedge, which we talked about so much. So the precept there is you forecheck hard, but you also back check hard, right? You get to the outside of the forward, force him along the wall. Then you've got a 6'5" body coming with the squeeze, right? And all of a sudden, you've created just so much pressure on opponents to, you know, make like five skilled plays in a row if they're going to generate anything, or honestly, sometimes even enter the zone cleanly with possession. So it's sort of the buzzing around. It's going F1 on the forecheck, but it's also coming back F2, F3 with that same level of speed and sort of flushing puck carriers into giant bodies on the back end that really helped drive, you know, what Rick Tocchet talked about on that Millard podcast, which was, you know, the fact that they gave up so little on the rush, the fact that they were very, very difficult to take a can opener to through the neutral zone. And it was pretty rare that we saw a team like Winnipeg did it their first meeting of the season, where Winnipeg just passed it through them twice in a row and kind of won that game. But I mean, how many times did we see that all season? Like 10? You know, like it was hard to effectively like punish the Canucks pass rush, right? Because that's effectively what they're doing. They're exerting pressure down ice to drive pressure in the neutral zone that catches opponents leaning, and you try to generate off that. So, you know, I do think that that hallmark to how this team played is essential. And yet when it comes to what can speed do for you as a concept, yep. I increasingly am convinced that where this team, like even with Lafferty expiring, like is Lafferty the only burner, like the only afterburner type skater who's expiring, yep. right? Like their speed's almost kind of locked in, right? Like Garland might not have straight line speed, but he's super quick. You know, JT Miller's first step, likewise, elite quickness guy. Nils Höglander, genuinely fast. Ilya Mikheyev, especially with the burst he had in the second half, genuinely fast. Phil DiGiuseppe, Neil Zaman, you still have like some locked in depth guys with speed. I mean, the if this team's going to, when Alvin says he wants to add speed, like I wonder, is that speed with the skill to score?
Mm.
Is that speed with the ability to play more consistently to an identity than I think the Canucks got from Sam Lafferty, right? Who just like, I like Lafferty as a defensive player, and I thought he played well all season for the most part, but ultimately you get into the playoffs, you get into those heavy games, and, you know, are you doing cardio or are you making an impact with your speed, right? Like, that's sort of a question that I don't think we got an answer to from him over the course of the postseason. Where the team kind of lacks speed is outside of Quinn Hughes on the back end.
Yeah.
Right? Filip Hronek's a really good skater, but he doesn't like handle the puck dynamically through the neutral zone. He's not carrying the puck. You know, he's mostly dangerous from the blue line in, right? His skating helps him keep a narrow gap defensively more than it allows him to, like, you know, blow the zone himself and sort of lead the rush or sometimes even join the rush taking fourth man's ice. So, you know, he's a little bit more of a static defender, I think, than the idea we have in our mind's eye of this like dynamic puck mover. That's not really his game.
Well, they're and when after I think Quinn about, Hughes, they're probably their best guys at skating it through the neutral zone themselves. Probably Nikita Zadorov and Tyler Myers, right? That's two and
yeah,
three.
Well, and I would say Zadorov on a different level.
Sure.
But yes.
But I think three is Tyler Myers.
So you're putting them ahead of Hronek.
Yes. How often?
Yeah, no, like,
just in terms of how often we see it and the success, I think they're absolutely ahead of Hronek in that regard.
Play style? Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And so, you know, when Rick Tocchet discusses the idea of generating more rush offense, right? The idea of trying to turn the dial. I mean, I do think one of the major things we saw from the Canucks last season was that they really struggled to generate shots on goal without Quinn Hughes on the ice. Like, I do fundamentally think more speed on the back end to drive offense is where, you know, I think this team has some room to grow, because it's not like you're, obviously you'd love to generate more too with that like Miller Hughes duo on the ice together, but they generated enough. Like what you're really trying to do is raise the baseline of, you know, what this team, like this team generated absolutely nothing in the playoffs with Soucy and Myers on the ice, right? Like that pair had like 10 goals an hour. Right, it was like a black hole offensively, and likewise, although to a lesser extent, with, you know, Zadorov and Ian Cole. So yeah, so I mean, to me, that's like you want to grow this team's offensive game. I do think more creativity in the top six is necessary. Don't get me wrong; there were obviously way too many minutes where you had, I mean, first of all, you had Pew Suter on the top line. You know how much I like Pew Suter and how much I liked how that line looked as a trio. I thought it was the Canucks' best option. But ideally, you'd have someone who's going to, you know, pitch in a little bit more in terms of bottom line goal scoring in that role. And then, you know, you had so many times, so many minutes where you're like pigeonholing a Mikheyev or a Lafferty or even a Phil DiGiuseppe into the top six. And, you know, the Canucks do need someone who can eat a little bit more, I think, on the wings, and I think they're aware of that. So that's obviously number one. But number two, I do think if you're going to generate more, especially if you're going to generate more off the rush, having like a more dynamic puck mover, someone who can, you know, ideally still fit within this way, like this very specific way that Rick Tocchet wants to play and attack teams in the neutral zone and defend the rush. But when they force the turnover, you know, maybe it's making a guy miss and finding that outlet. Just like finding those quick ups that a player like Bouchard, now he's an elite player, so don't get me wrong, like you're not going to find something like that, but approximating more of that where within structure, you're still able to counterattack perhaps a little bit more cogently with, you know, another, not Quinn Hughes level guy, but like you know, a Justin Schultz level guy, like someone who can make that play to spring the attack. And then ideally do a little bit more and a little bit more to drive high quality looks from the blue line into the offensive zone. Like, to me, if you're going to add speed, that's kind of the place that I'd target. Especially because I do think the Canucks are going to have enough speed, no matter what players they lose in free agency, to still sort of effectively be a team that's capable of executing Tocchet's vision the way they did this year.
And the point about it at trying to add speed on the blue line is a really interesting one, because it's such a difficult needle to thread with the importance and how much success they had focusing on the size of the blue line, right? And the way they got the, you know, the results they got out of having Myers and Zadorov and Soucy all playing on the same blue line together. So it's a question of, okay, now, there's, as we all know, there's only so many really big and really fast and talented defensemen in the NHL, and they tend to be very, very expensive to acquire. So how much can you turn the dial towards, okay, getting some more skills, some more skating ability on the blue line without sacrificing that part of your identity that you built, right? And they might have to sacrifice a little bit of the identity, right? We can get into the updates on Zadorov and Myers and Joshua forward in the next segment. You might be forced to pivot a little bit away from just strictly focusing on having Giants back there anyways, but I don't think they want to completely throw it out, right? And so if you...
No.
And I'm not saying you're suggesting that, right? But
no.
What's the balance, right? Is I guess what I'm getting at, right? Can you sign one guy who's, you know, 6 feet, not super undersized, but not a big player either, but who has that puck moving capability, and kind of get the best of both worlds in your mix on the back end?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's not going to be easy. It's like,
nope.
But there's so many UFA defensemen. It's actually kind of an interesting class. You know, just looking at guys and sorting them with like a minimum height of 6'2" in this free agent class, you're still going to have like Brady Shea, Justin Schultz, you know, obviously, Brett Pesce is probably outside anybody's reasonable sort of. Obviously, he's like on the higher end, but you're going to have options for guys who are 6'2" or taller and are strong skaters and are productive offensive defensemen. Now, they're going to be pricey, or at least Brady Shea is.
Yep.
Justin Schultz probably not so much, although, you know, I do think it's notable that his time in Pittsburgh with this management group didn't end cleanly, right? And when he was a UFA in 2022, and it couldn't have been more obvious that the Canucks had significant needs on the right side of their defense corps, my understanding is that their pursuit was tepid. So, you know, I'm not necessarily expecting that one, but there are options in unrestricted free agency, and certainly there are going to be options on the trade market. You know, I think you have to keep working toward that, right? Like, the evolution of this defense corps, I think, requires not abandoning what's made it work,
yep,
but trying to integrate what's made it work with a higher level of dynamism offensively and in terms of puck skills, and you know, hopefully in conjunction with more skilled forwards in your top six, you know, you're able to play the style that this Canucks team was able to play so successfully, that worked so well. I don't think you want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Like, I don't even think you want Tocchet to tweak it too much, given how difficult teams found it trying to solve what Vancouver was doing well, including the Edmonton Oilers. So, you know, it's more about evolving it with more skilled players capable of doing the same stuff for me than it is on Tocchet to change what he's doing, given how successful it's been.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get into some of the actual individual names that could help in this regard, both at defense and at forward, in terms of that speed factor. We'll do that on the other side. Some updates, kind of, on where things stand between Zadorov and Joshua and Myers and the Canucks as well. JanPro, the leaders in commercial cleaning and janitorial. If your workplace demands a clean environment, contact JanPro for a free, no obligation quote. Visit janpro.ca. More Canucks talk coming up here on the other side on Sportsnet 650.
Hey, it's Vic Nizar. Have your say and join me on The People's Show with big takes and even bigger bets weekdays 3 to 4 on Sportsnet 650 or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drantz. This hour brought to you by Avenue Machinery and Douglas Lake Equipment. Be a champion on the worksite. Find them together online at DLEAMC.com. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Dunbar Lumber with three stores to serve you in Ladner on Bridge Street or Dunbar Lumber Express at Ladner Center or Arbutus in Vancouver online at DunbarLumber.com. Kyle Bukauskas will join us live from Florida at 1 o'clock. Get his thoughts on Game 4 and the blowout win for the Oilers, and also, of course, look ahead to tomorrow night's Game 5. But before that, we were talking about the focus on, or the potential focus of the Canucks on speed in free agency, trying to add more speed, where they should do it on the roster, what it could add to the team. And you were highlighting that, you know, I think we tend to think of, okay, you need more speed as you need fast wingers, right? You need speed up front. But to your point, Drantz, there's also a lot that more speed could do for this team on the blue line. And we can start there from in terms of individual targets that could make sense for the Canucks. And, you know, again, you had the piece up with Harmon Dial at The Athletic looking at free agent targets, pending unrestricted free agents that could make sense in this regard for the Canucks. Three names on the blue line in the piece, and kind of, I would say, at different tiers of the free agent demand or the roster,
yep,
you know, where they make sense on your roster. And Sean Walker, one, Oliver Shillington out of Calgary, another, and Hayden Fleury, most recently of the Tampa Bay Lightning, the three that you guys highlighted as potential defenseman targets to add a little bit of speed to the lineup.
Yeah, and later this week, we're going to have a defenseman list with like 16 names on
sure.
it. So, you know, really what we tried to hone in on here is the really elite skating defenseman, right? Like, I'm talking like incredibly quick skaters. And, you know, Walker is... especially now that he's recovered from mm-hmm. that really brutal multiple ligament injury in his knee in 2022. You know, last year he showed it. I mean, he is a world-class skater, right? Four-way mobility through the roof. I mean, that's the sort of defender who's also defensively responsible enough, I think, to play talk-it hockey, you know, that would fundamentally alter the composition of the Canucks' back end, right-handed, but versatile enough, can kind of play anywhere. I mean... You know, I don't know how you afford him because I would imagine he'll have significant options
yep.
on the open market this summer. But I suppose in a world where the club couldn't come to terms with Hronek, right? I do think he's the sort of two-way defender that could, you know, maybe have that, you know, Ethan Bear-like impact on Quinn Hughes. You know, somewhere between Bear's impact and Hronek's impact, ideally.
He seems to make the most sense as like a Hronek plan B to me. You know what I mean? It's like, hey, we
right.
couldn't get it done with Hronek. 100%. Worst case scenario, let's go see our options and try to plug Sean Walker in there.
Yeah, especially because he's a little bit like he's over the tier of what this team probably can afford to spend on a second pair defenseman.
Yeah.
And yet below the tier of like that impact first pair guy, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
That we still think this team needs, right? Like a real second pair driver. And by the way, I'm not saying that to, you know, sort of solicit texts to the inbox that are like, well, isn't Hronek a guy who can drive his own pair? I don't care. Like I want Hronek playing with Quinn Hughes. So I still think you need another one. Even if Hronek is that guy, you still then need someone who can play with Quinn Hughes and have that same impact
mm-hmm.
that Hronek did. So, you know, it's more in line with my theory that you need another top pair caliber defenseman in Vancouver. And Walker's like just below that tier, you know, and so probably not worth the investment, but certainly an interesting name who's super fast. Oliver Shillington, likewise, a really good skater. I don't know that he's defensively at a level that would really endear himself to Rick Tocchet, right? Like I think on defense, you better be able to play pretty physical hockey if you're going to earn real minutes
yep.
from Tocchet here. I don't know if he's on that level. So more like, you know, probably a third pair guy if you had the right partner to play with him. Another versatile guy, can play left or right relatively comfortably, has obviously dealt with some personal matters that have limited his action over the last 18 months. So, you know, I don't want to sort of get into that side of it, but you would have to make sure that it's a situation where you can properly support a player, right? And make sure that he's comfortable and you can get the best out of him. But, you know, an exceptionally fast skater would certainly help add some offensive punch, especially in a third pair role for the Canucks. And then, you know, Hayden Fleury I wanted to include just because he is a phenomenal skater. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, one of those guys you watch and you just think, man, this guy has all of the tools. Now, he's never really put it together, but I actually kind of like that template from a Canucks perspective, right? I mean, we've seen what, you know, hey, there's some two-way gaps in this physically imposing, incredibly athletic defender, and his decision-making sometimes leaves something to be desired. It's like, that's what everyone said about Zadorov.
Yep.
That's what everyone said about Myers. You know, I'm here for the Canucks gambling on a couple guys with that profile, given the success that they've had plugging and playing exactly that type of defender into this system. And, you know, to me, that's the sort of like low cost dice roll worth taking. So I just wanted to spotlight him as well as kind of an interesting depth option who would certainly add a fair bit of foot speed and also the versatility to play left or right, although I think you primarily want him on the left to the Canucks back end.
Yeah, Hayden Fleury is an interesting one for exactly the reason you were saying there, right? And you think about, okay, if you're – look, we're going to continue to focus on raising the ceiling of this team, right? Because I think that's where their focus is going to be. But you also have to do that while trying to maintain as much of the floor as you can. And part of that is – when you have injuries, right? When things crop up, can you bring players in who can still do Rick Tocchet type of thing, right? And when you talk about Hayden Fleury, a guy who's 6'4", big, mobile, maybe you don't want him in your, you know, as one of your starting six defensemen to start the season. But if he's your number seven and somebody's out for a year, well, that's a really enticing package for the Canucks coaching staff to work with and to be able to plug into your lineup when something goes wrong and still get something close to the style of play, at least, that Rick Tocchet wants. And then, of course, you're always, you know, I never have a problem with gambling on high pedigree guys with the physical tools that he has, especially if you are being reasonable about what you're expecting from them, right? And not getting a little bit ahead of yourself from what you're expecting from them. And then, yeah, Shillington's an interesting one, as you said, because of does he have the defensive kind of oomph to his game to earn those minutes from Rick Tocchet? But again, what we were talking about in the first segment, like you might have to not major compromises, but make at least a little bit of compromise if you are going to be able to generate more offense from the blue line, right? Now, it doesn't mean you have to completely throw out your principles, but do you have to bend a little bit on them here or there? Is it plan A? Probably not, but could it be something where if he's still available, you know, a week into free agency after July 1st that you start to kick the tires on and think, okay, hey, it's not a perfect scenario, but we're willing to make it work? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, well, and I don't think it's... like, I don't think it's a, I think it's an identity and a preference thing more than it's like a philosophical thing necessarily. Although we'll see how they conduct themselves. You know, like at the end of the day, there are 6 foot tall defensemen in this league that can play as hard as any 6 foot five
yep.
defenseman in this league. Right. I mean, there really are. So, you know, for the right personality type, the right competitor, you know, I think you have to be flexible on sort of the dimensions of your back end. And, you know, I still think offense needs to be just about everything for this team. Like, I really do think, you know, I know there's some discussion given some of the updates that are coming out, right? Like Zadorov going to be hard to keep. Both sides seem pretty motivated to at least push it to the 11th hour and we'll see, right? You know, Lindholm looks like
sounds
he's
like
heading out,
yep.
But honestly, never say never on these guys, especially given the limitations on third line centermen, right? Like there are so few ways to fill the gaps at center that you never know what offers the team maybe decides to make in sort of the waning hours before he hits the market. I mean, I've covered a lot of free agent contracts that got done at 11 a.m., like an hour before the market opened, right? For a reason. And then, you know, Dakota Joshua, I know the Joshua one, everyone sort of understands that there's going to be a market for him and a market for those types of players. I think that was Friedman's wording on Dolly and Dolly. Mm-hmm. Donnie and Dolly. Dolly and Dolly. Wow, yeah. That would be a lot.
Well, it was just there was no Donnie today. It was just Dolly. It was Dolly and Henderson.
Oh, so it was the Dolly.
Yeah, it was Dolly.
Wow.
And Dolly. Yeah.
Wow. More Dollies than a Scottish lamb.
Hey, give Henderson
sheep,
some love, huh?
I said it was Dolly and Henderson.
Dolly. It Dolly and Henderson.
We don't need to give Henderson some love. Whatever. Anyway, I love Hendo, obviously. I do think it's worth unpacking the Joshua thing just really quickly.
Yeah,
right? Because there are no other Joshuas. Not on the market this summer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there aren't, right? Like, there is no one else that matches that combination, right? Of, like, speed, size, physicality, multiple 10-goal seasons, 20-plus goal pace this past year, and then you throw in, like, penalty killing and played top 6 minutes for a team that made the second round of the Stanley Cup playoffs, in the postseason. Like, you can throw out whatever name of hard-nosed forward X you want. Like, Martinuk, he doesn't have Joshua's hands in tight. Nason,
mm-hmm.
He's not Joshua's size. Like, there's only one. There's only one guy with this profile, and he's got the sort of profile that teams will look at and think, hey, he can maybe even play in our top six. Like, he might be able to play in our top six. So that also pushes the number higher. When you're that unique in this type of market, like this type of, seller's market, I mean, I throw him at the very top of my watch list for a guy whose number could get truly silly.
Yep.
If he hits July 1. Like, I think there's going to be a bidding war. And I don't think it's going to be comparable to anything else we see. Like, I think the market ultimately will bear something different in the event that Joshua doesn't resign in Vancouver for him than it will for any of the other, you know, like, even your, like, middle and non-DeBrusque category, like, non-top six, bona fide top six, multiple 20-goal guys. I mean, I think he's going to have a totally different market than the other, like, middle six grindy types on July 1. He's 1-1. Like, teams will pay for rarity, period.
And from a player's perspective, right, because one of the things we keep hearing from Rick Dhaliwal is, look, the team wants to keep him, and he would like to stay in an ideal world. But you also understand the closer you get to free agency, it's really hard for a player to pass up even the opportunity to talk to other teams, right? Especially given Dakota Joshua's career arc and the style he plays, you can be very, very attached to a team and a city and a market and very comfortable playing there and really, really want to. But man, that's a massive, massive carrot that's waiting for you, right? On July, just 2 weeks, 2 weeks from today, you can start fielding all of these offers and see if things get really silly. And that's an expensive, it costs a lot to buy a player out from doing that, right? To say, we're going to give you so much enough money that you don't even want to do that anymore. That's a really expensive thing from a Canucks perspective. I will say, like, your point about there are no other Dakota Joshuas, I think that's a good point, and especially from a league-wide perspective, why there's going to be so much focus on him. You know, I keep coming back to the Patrick Alvin line about we'll find the next Dakota Joshua, because Dakota Joshua wasn't this Dakota Joshua when the Canucks signed him, right? He was a group six unrestricted free agent. They got him for 2 years under $1 million. They obviously saw the potential there. They thought he could turn into something like this, but he was far from a finished product when they signed him. He might still not be a finished product.
He wasn't even an everyday NHL player.
Exactly. So now the interesting thing, though, is it's a lot easier to say, well, we'll roll the dice on this guy and try to build him into something when you're not coming off being one game away from going to the conference final, right? Because can you wait even a year for somebody, for another project to really, you know, show the rewards of working with the player development staff and development of that player? Or do you need a guy you can count on right away from night one of the season in that role? And I think that's just, to me, I'm all for, hey, try and find the next Dakota Joshua, go out, look at these undervalued guys, group six UFAs, all of that, try to develop them into Joshua. But inherent in that, there's a little bit of a lag. Even if you're successful, right? Even if you identify the right guy and work with them and get more out of his game, you're not going to get that in October of next year. It could be a little bit down the road before you get that.
Yeah, which is, you know, why maybe you end up putting a couple different eggs in a basket.
Yep.
Right? Maybe it's a Christian Fisher type and a Yakov Trenin type. Maybe it's a more established NHL player who you still have to pay, but maybe don't have to pay the way you're paying Joshua, like a Brandon Duhaime, right? More of a classic bottom six profit. Like, if you're signing Dakota Joshua, I think there's a reasonable expectation that, like, hey, this guy might be able to play top six for us. Like, mm-hmm. we're betting on him. Our base rate bet is that he's a third liner, like a really good third liner with a unique profile. But we're not going to be stunned if we actually get more than that. No one's making that bet with Brandon Duhaime. No one's making that bet with Yakov Trenin. No one's making that bet with Christian Fisher. But ultimately, you know, that's kind of where the Canucks might, like, maybe you throw an upside bet, right? Like an upside bet on someone who could develop into Dakota Joshua for you in 18 months, and a floor bet as well. Right?
On a guy,
honestly, maybe they've already cast. They might have already made that upside bet with Vasily Podkolzin. Right, they already have like the top 10 pick, blah blah blah, guy in the system signed for 2 years at $1 million. Like, they might already have that upside bet placed. So you find a floor bet so that if Podkolzin's not ready, if he doesn't have the sort of summer you want, if he's still kind of got the yips come training camp, at least you've got a way to pivot and not sacrifice too much forward size in your lineup, which, you know, we know how crucial Joshua was to that. So lots of options available to them in the event that they can't retain Joshua. Joshua Zadorov, to me, are the guys where, and all of these guys are kind of fit this mold. Like, even Lindholm, I can make the argument for, given the dearth of other options. But for me, Zadorov and Joshua are both unique enough in terms of their profile that I do think paying a premium to retain them is, you know, if not wise, at least defensible, at least understandable. And certainly I could see the wisdom in doing it, just given how crucial they were to this team's identity. And frankly, given my willingness to at least see, like, I'd at least be interested in seeing what it looks like if Joshua came back and was a full-time
top six
winger. Because I'm not convinced he can't do it, right? Like, I'd be interested to see what Joshua could do mixing in on power play one, because I've seen those hands in tight. I've seen him work on retrievals. I've seen him compliment skill guys. I've seen him at the net front. And I'm not convinced that he can't do it. Like, I think he could probably do it, to be totally honest with you. And then Zadorov, I mean, he played so many minutes in the playoffs and looked the part. Like, elevated his game. There's an intelligence, right, in terms of how he plays. You know, not subtlety, I want to be clear. There's not subtlety in how he plays, but there's an intelligence in the way that he goes about, you know, everything from, like, inflicting pain to addressing the market to criticizing the referees, but doing it in a calculated way. Like, there's an intelligence to his game that, you know, looks an awful lot to me like the kinds of guts and brains you need to win in this league. You know, I think he's got a lot of that. You do have to be careful paying for intangible stuff like that, obviously, but I also think he can play. So those two guys, you know, if the Canucks find a way, and even if the price tag gives us some sticker shock, the rarity of those profiles, how in demand they will be if they get to July 1, I think should at least cushion or serve as context for whatever number they end up coming in at, if the Canucks are able to get either guy done.
Yeah, Joshua feels like the one you're least likely or less likely to regret. You know what I mean? Because I do think there's more of a chance
he's got a straightforward path
that his role can increase, right? Like, even just,
yeah,
like,
I agree.
Can't you just picture in your mind's eye, like, Joshua on the left wing with Miller and Besser, and that looking really, really interesting next year, right? If you're talking about moving a guy up in the lineup. Now, I'm not saying Zadorov can't take more of that minutes load, because, as you said, he did it in the playoffs and it looked really good. But if I just had to choose one of those two guys who can more likely play a bigger role and move up and therefore make their contract actually look pretty good, it would be Dakota Joshua. I should point out also, or pass along at least, as we talk about some of the reports out there from Rick Dhaliwal and Elliot Friedman on Zadorov, on Donnie and Dolly today, saying most likely they won't be able to keep Zadorov, but it's not impossible. He says in a perfect world, he'd like to stay. Of course, that's Zadorov in Vancouver. He's willing to take a little bit less, but there's a limit. He says, I was expecting the two sides to talk. Don't know how likely it is, but I refuse to close the door 100%. And I believe it was Rick Dhaliwal on Friday who said he kind of expected the Canucks to make, quote, their final offer, or at least what they're saying is their final offer at the time over the weekend. Didn't really have an update for us on Monday on that, right? Basically said it's still quiet, and that seems to be where the Canucks are with pretty much everyone right now, right? Like, not a lot of urgency 2 weeks before free agency to try to get things done. And I think part of that is probably, you know, I'm sure they're going through a similar process to what you and Harmon are doing at The Athletic, right? Like, okay, who are the guys that we like? What are they likely to cost on July 1st? Who can we plug in if we have to replace these players, and doing that mapping out strategy so you know your options?
Yeah, and what can we return in a trade? What does the market look like for that? What is Philip Hronek going to come into, and how do we want to allocate cap space this summer, right? And honestly, what futures are we willing to trade if we're going to go land a big piece, right? Mm. You know, the idea that the club would have significant interest in Gensel, right, looms large, right? Like, at the end of the day, you know, if this team is big game hunting, well, you don't want to sign necessarily like Joshua and Zadorov at $9 million total.
Nope.
Right? When you've still got Hronek to do at 7.5 to 8, because there you go. That's it. Like, now you're filling out the roster, and those are your big offseason ads. Whereas if you think there's going to be an opportunity to reel in a big fish to bolster your top six, like a star level player, right? The old like Kessel, Recchi, Waite tier proven scoring forwards that Rutherford teams have tended to add when they think they're on the precipice of contending. I mean, you know, you kind of have to figure out the biggest slice of the pie, right? Before you figure out exactly how much everyone's getting and whether or not there's enough to go around for Zadorov to get seconds.
Yeah.
And I just kind of think that's where, I don't know. I just assume Zadorov would be a seconds guy.
Oh,
maybe not.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I think that's kind of it. Like, you'd love to keep these players. The Canucks may end up keeping these players. And yet, you know, I think we can tell from the reporting around this team and their own public commentary that just keeping the band back together is not the goal.
We'll take a break here. We will chat Stanley Cup Final with Kyle Bukauskas from Sportsnet and Hockey Night in Canada. Next, the pride of Campbell River joins us here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650.